What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Young people in China have their own unique view of the future. Briefly, let's hear from them. Xi Jinping's report to the 19th Party Congress outlines his vision for the future of China. But what do the country's young people really desire? My ideal lifestyle is one that I don't have to worry about the environment, the air, the water, and I don't have to worry about housing. Whether people will respect me when I'm off campus. I feel like houses are for investments these days. They are not necessities. You don't necessarily need to buy a house. You can rent one. In terms of lifestyle, I hope I have more free time. I want to be able to work hard for a while and then do what I want for the rest of the time, like read a book. That's how I see myself. Do you think you can realize your dreams? Yes. Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. Welcome to America Trends as we begin a two-part series on young people in China. Now, I know that we call our podcast America Trends, but that's meant to suggest that we take on topics that in the near future will have a significant impact on the United States. It's hard to imagine that Chinese millennials will not be a significant factor in America's future. They dwarf our large millennial population in size, think differently about their role in the world, and they look differently at the world than previous Chinese generations. And they perhaps understand the West better than we understand them. We hope that we can contribute to a greater understanding of who they are by way of this mini-series on young China and how it will affect all of us by way of this podcast. Now, you'll hear searing commentary on all of this from two young American journalists who have spent a good deal of time in China. On today's episode, we introduce you to Roseanne Lake, who is currently the Cuba correspondent for the prestigious Economist magazine. She was previously based in Beijing, where she worked for 5 years as a television reporter and journalist. Her China coverage has appeared in Time, The Atlantic, Slate, and on Vice. Her book, Leftover in China, The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower, is the focus of today's conversation. Roseanne, I've got to ask you, it doesn't seem to fit the model, your book, Leftover in China, because we think that there are just so many men, and you do talk about the surplus, but you explain to us why there's a disconnect in relation to this. But most people listening would just think, well, there's got to be more guys than women, so why the leftovers?
That's a great question, and it's actually one of the first ones I asked myself when I got to China. I was working at a television station, and I was surrounded by lots of very accomplished young women in their early 20s. And I discovered soon after Chinese New Year that they were being sort of lacquered with a fresh layer of pressure for not being married. And I thought, well, first of all, you know, your parents shouldn't be so hard on you because here you are, you're, you know, some of the first women in your families to go to college. You're working at an international news network in a big city. You've made it to the big city. You're supporting yourself. You know, what's the big deal? You'll come home with someone eventually if you wish, you know, in good time. And if not, it's not the end of the world. But another part of me also wondered, well, you know, why don't you have boyfriends? China does have a surplus of men, right? We know that from the worst years of the one-child policy, given China's traditional preference for boys, there were a lot of gendercides, right? There were a lot of baby girls killed, about 32 million to be exact. And so I thought, well, you know, it shouldn't be that hard if there are this many extra men floating around China. And what I realized is that it actually all comes down to the geography of where these men are spread out across the country. And that's sort of what got me to the core of what the book is about. These men were overwhelmingly born in rural areas of China where parents were more traditional and more keen to have a son. that they could raise and you know, have work on the farm. Whereas in urban areas, parents were a bit more open-minded and willing to keep a girl. You know, we have a girl, okay, we'll keep her, we'll raise her. And what ends up happening is, you know, China's many, many baby girls are killed upon birth or shortly after, or aborted before they're able to be born. But of the ones who survive and who are born, they end up being raised kind of as sons, for lack of brothers, right? Mm. And because they're China's first generation of only daughters, they're tasked with the responsibilities of being the family's son, but also the daughter, which leads to some confusing situations that I get into a little further down. But that's the basics, right? There is a huge surplus of men, but they're overwhelmingly concentrated in rural areas, whereas, you know, women, especially the women that I chronicle in the book, are overwhelmingly urban, because it's where parents were more keen to have girls and where these girls benefited the most from China's economic prosperity over these past 30 years.
But with all the government planning that goes on, you would think that this is something that the government might have accounted for and tried to figure out how they can marry, if you will, that imbalance, no?
Not at all. I mean, you would think it's something that they would have wanted to consider, and it certainly is a matter of concern now. The Chinese government is aware that they have a huge population of leftover men in the rural areas of the country. They're actually known as guanggun, or bare branches, in respect to the fact that they will, it's very unlikely that they'll have offspring, because numerically there just aren't enough women to go around. And in China, where marriage holds a very, very serious part in society, I mean, it's the official stamp of adulthood. You've really not, you know, managed to become a full person in life unless you've married and probably even just as importantly, produce grandchildren or a grandchild for your parents. So China is aware of this, and some of the pressure is being alleviated by unfortunate means such as bride napping or, you know, agencies who will offer to bring in a bride from Vietnam or Cambodia to you know, meet the demand in China, thereby causing imbalances in these countries. But it's also put a lot of pressure on parents in rural areas, because they know the competition is fierce and they all want to marry off their sons. And so the only way they can think of increasing their son's value in the marriage market, because it really is a market, is by accumulating wealth. So accumulating a house would be a great way to do that. And it gets down, I mean, in some regions where the numbers are particularly imbalanced, this sort of competition to have a house, you know, reaches dizzying proportions. There are reports that things that I've written about of, you know, certain villages where parents will put a phantom third story on a home that they build for their son. So basically a home with two stories and a fake third story so that it looks taller from the outside, and so that the person who is tasked with, you know, finding a match for their son will think, oh, you know, this family has a large house. It should be easier to marry off their son, and so, you know, we're going to give him prime ranking in the pipeline. So it's put a lot of pressure on parents, because of course men themselves don't have enough wealth to be able to purchase a home, and so it's become a family affair, and then it's putting a lot of pressure on everybody.
Well, finally, a commonality with a lot of young men in America. But let me ask you, before we get back to the women, the leftovers, and this is fascinating, the men, we've always been told that there was going to be a problem, perhaps with Chinese society, because they needed a safety valve, these men. They had certain wants and needs. If you have 25 million, 30 million or more men who just don't have a mate, is China still worried about that?
I mean, they certainly are, and I think it's unlikely that, you know, China start a war to get rid of some of them. That's a solution that's been, not a solution, but it's been a theory that's been floated. I think that's highly unlikely. That just doesn't strike me as anything that, you know, China has in its plans. And things could take a different turn. I mean, one solution would be, you know, they could legalize gay marriage. That's not going to take care of the entire surplus, but it would certainly alleviate some of the pressure. Traditionally, that's not something that's very aligned with Chinese values, but if it's a practical solution, maybe somewhere down the line it's something they could consider. I mean, they are saddled with a complex demographic situation, and it's only made more complicated by the fact that their population is dwindling in a way that they don't want it to be, right? All of China is the ultimate superlative. It's why I found it such an attractive place to report from. All of its power, almost everything it's managed to accomplish, has come from its sheer power in numbers. And that power is in trouble now, right? The birth rate's been below replacement for a very long time. The one-child policy played a significant hand in that. But now that it's a two-child policy, we're seeing, I mean, that two-child policy is now 2 years old. We're seeing that the numbers that the government predicted for population growth after the policy was relaxed are nowhere near what they expected. And so China needs to do something, right? It's about getting these women married off. It's about finding partners for these men. There's no obvious solution other than immigration. Not something that, you know, China's not something that they do particularly well either. Demographers I've spoken with say, you know, it could go a few ways. It's either, you know, you're turning the tap on full blast and this becomes a very serious issue, or gradually here and there it will work itself out. Men will marry and divorce. They will marry younger women. They'll marry older women. I mean, it could work itself out, but I mean, not completely, right? But it's hard to predict whether or not it's going to be something very acute or whether it's just going to be a problem for China for at least up until 2070, because that's just about how long it will take for the gender imbalances that were actually, they reached their worst year in 2005. 2005 was the worst year for imbalanced sex ratio that birth in China, which very few people know. And so, you know, those kids are 13 years old. Those little boys who are 13 are going to have a very hard time because, you know, within their own age cohort, there's a limited supply of women, plus all of the populations of, you know, all the generations of men before them who are looking for a wife that may have missed out within their own age cohort. So it's not an easy problem.
No, not at all. And we're all reading about the Chinese and how determined they are to really create an economic bandwidth that is pretty incredible around the world. What is the impact of the demographics that we're talking about and these leftovers? Because you remind us that these young women will prove crucial for the country's future. So what does this portend?
Well, I think the leftovers do play a key part of all of this, because right now China has two main concerns. It's one, maintaining the economic growth of the country, right? That has been very impressive these past 20 years, but of course it's also been very extreme. Keeping that up at a sustainable pace is not something that too many countries have managed to do. So if China wants to keep up its growth, one of the main things it needs to do is stimulate domestic consumption. That's not been something that it's been traditionally very good at. Most of China's economic growth comes from real estate and from, in, you know, very generous loans from the government to major state-owned enterprises that put up airports and build bridges and do all these infrastructural investments that we're now starting to see some of them have been feckless, right? Some of them are not profitable investments. And so this is money that, you know, these corporations can't pay back, and that the banks and by extension the people, by not getting real interest on the money in the bank, are paying back. And so domestic consumption is really one of the ways, now that those big loans have sort of run out and there's not that much more to build, that is just going to show up as almost automatic economic growth or movement of capital, domestic consumption really needs to be stimulated. And so if you're involving half of your population in the workforce, if you're allowing them to reach their full educational and professional potential and also their earning potential, what better way to do that, right? We know that women are an important part of the consumer equation. This is especially true in China. So it's important to make sure that you're giving them the conditions to be able to stimulate your economy. And then the second part of that is population growth, right? If you're not making it easy for your women to have children for you, if you're calling them left over by the time they reach age 27, but also kind of expecting them to have all these sorts of fancy degrees from foreign countries, which is happening increasingly because I said earlier, you know, these girls are treated as sons. The resources that their brothers may have gotten, they got instead. And many of them grew up in urban areas where their parents benefited from the growth in the economy, and so they reinvested that into their daughters. And so the timelines have shifted, and China needs to think seriously about how it's going to make it possible for those women to deliver what they're completely capable of doing, because they've had access to the education and opportunities that will set them up for a successful life, without sort of holding them back because of tradition that hasn't evolved as quickly. And I write about you know, the perils of turning into Japan, because we see something very similar happen there. Japan is another East Asian tiger economy. Its economy took off very quickly, and unlike China, it failed to have women involved in the formal economy. And as a result, it's a nation comprised of a very high percentage of homemakers, right? Japanese women, after having a child, often check out of the workforce for about 13 years. And that's the result of a lot of factors, but one of the big ones is the fact that it's a bit of a stigma to outsource childcare. And so this is a big part of the workforce in Japan that's missing. And Christine Lagarde has said it often, and Abe is now starting to come around and understand this, and it's becoming a more important part of Japanese policy. But the economy is not what it should be, and a big part of that is because the women have not been involved. So what I argue is, you know, China has done an excellent job, some of it on purpose and some of it completely by accident, of educating its women and, you know, positioning them to be successful. What it shouldn't do now is get caught up in tradition and, you know, throw to waste all of that really good work it's done in bringing a huge population out of poverty and educating them and making them productive members of its society by sticking to, you know, traditional timelines for motherhood and for marriage and not making it possible for women to sort of have a family and a work balance, right, to realize their potential on both fronts.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
So are they working toward that? Or are they saying, well, it's more important that you get married as opposed to taking that great education and putting it toward the economic development of the country? Or, well, both are needed. I mean, they need more people, but they also need these wonderfully engaged young women. So how do they, again, marry those two things?
Well, it seems like they've changed their tune a bit. I would say that a couple of years ago, the voice of tradition was a bit louder. But now that the two-child policy, the reality of the dwindling population has really sunk in to the extent that there's been a significant policy change, right? There's now a two-child policy. If you sort of read closely in revisions to the Constitution and that will likely be made in March, all signs are pointing to the fact that this policy will probably be abolished entirely by March. And so a new sort of pro-birth policy seems to be in place, family building and encouraging childbirth. If it becomes clear enough to the government that a part of that means adjusting timelines and removing unsavory labels. And I should also stress, this isn't just all in the hands of the government. And actually, if you're, you know, a Chinese woman in her 20s or 30s who's unmarried, your greatest source of pressure is definitely not coming to marry. It's definitely not coming from your government. It's coming from your parents, from your relatives, from your colleagues, from your taxi driver, from the guy who delivers water, from everybody. But it's not coming from your government. I mean, they play a hand in it because they're looking at the bigger picture and they're in charge of policy. But ultimately, the most important change that needs to happen is social, right? I mean, there could be, policies could change, but if mentalities don't, then, you know, nothing's going to progress anyway.
But as they look at the outside world and they see in America, for example, where many women are on their own, professional, living without a mate or living without marriage and having a career and then ultimately getting married at 30, 35, having a child at 40. Is that having any impact? Because I know they import a lot of the ideas that the West has.
No, this is all dangerous. This is destabilizing. this is not how we like to operate.
Are movies getting through?
No, this is not true. I mean, there's a long way to go, and part of it is because, you know, marriage has been such an integral part of Chinese society for hundreds of years. You know, up until 1990, less than something like 2% of the population remained unwed. It was universal and it was obligatory. So what's happening now is so momentous because it's completely destabilizing. I mean, according to sort of post-Qing dynasty wisdom, a home is a building block of a state, of the state, right? And so a harmonious home means a harmonious state. And it's a very easy way of organizing such a large population. And of course, a stable home means a mother, a father, and a child or children. And the fact that that model is changing in China, it definitely has people uneasy, and it's not something that they've made easy. For example, a woman who's not married in China can't freeze her eggs. She can't freeze her eggs, period. The only women in China who can freeze eggs are women who are married and who have an illness that may ultimately engender her ability to have children in the future. China has the technology to be able to do it, but this just isn't an option that they're willing to give women yet. And it's one that they should probably consider, right? If all demographic trends in the country are showing that women are getting married later, then that's probably something that they would, you know, want to offer. But it's not an option. And many Chinese women actually come to the United States to have that procedure because it's just insurance that they want to have for the future. No, not sure whether or not they're going to use it, but it's something that they like to have. And an important part of that is also having the capital to be able to afford to do that, because it's also an expensive thing to do, but they're doing it. But China's not quite there yet. They haven't quite warmed up to the idea of a family unit that's anything other than the nuclear family unit. There are lots of layers of tradition on top of that before that can change.
I'd just be curious about divorce in China. You did talk about the fact that somebody might have a second family and maybe some of the leftovers become the brides of those individuals. How is divorce looked upon?
You know, that's a great question. Some of the moms who I interviewed for this book would say to their daughters, it's better to marry and divorce than to not marry at all. For as traditional of a society as China is, divorce is frowned upon, of course. It's never considered an ideal, but it is preferable to remaining single forever. It's at least, well, you tried. You ticked that box. We hosted a wedding. All of our friends came. They saw that you entered society as an adult, as an adult as you should be, right? But whether or not you choose to stay in the institution is not as much of a matter of concern. And if you've managed to get married and stay married long enough to produce a grandchild, we'll probably look the other way. We can deal with this.
I don't know what percentage of the women we're talking about came to the United States to be educated. We met a wonderful young woman from China who was part of a master's program that my daughter was in. And I don't know if she is going to be going back, but what impact are those women having on the thought process?
Well, those women end up being they end up in a sticky situation. And ever since I moved back to the U.S., I've gotten to know more and more of them and to sort of fully understand what it means to choose to go back. There are about 330,000 Chinese students studying in the U.S. Over half of them are women. So that's a lot of women who have to consider whether or not they're going to go back to a society that's traditional or whether they're going to stay here and carve out a different life. Some that I've spoken to, ended up saying, okay, well, I'll go back because I'm being pressured to marry. And honestly, job opportunities in China have improved over the past few years to the extent that, before the decision was always very clear. People would say, my job opportunities are better in the U.S., I stay in the U.S. But now, if you look at big firms, Tencent, Toutiao, JD, there are more opportunities, especially in the tech space, the fintech space, and salaries could actually even be higher. Work hours are likely to be longer, but maybe not. Basically, the important thing to understand is now there are more compelling job offers back in China. So it makes it even more difficult. It's like, do I go back because I have a better job opportunity, but as far as my marriage prospects, that makes things more complicated. Some women have taken the approach, well, I'll go back to China, I can get a good job there, I'll work for a couple of years, and once I've hit 30 or 31, 32, 33, which is past my expiration date there, I'll come back to the U.S., where I'll still be relatively desirable and I could, sort of restart the mate search. That's an approach that some have taken. But for those who do, decide to go back and stay there, there's always this concern of most of the people that you've grown up with are probably married already. And because they've not had this experience of studying abroad and they've not kind of had that shift in ideas or just a different understanding of what possibilities are available. I mean, they call these people sea turtles, right? People who have left to study anywhere, not necessarily in the U.S., and who come back. And there are some social groups for them to hang out amongst one another because they kind of need it. You need a support group when you go back to sort of, deal with the reverse culture shock and the expectations that you maybe got to dodge for 4 years while you were studying in the U.S., 6 years, 8 years, because the U.S. academic year doesn't give you time off for Chinese New Year, so you get to skip, going home and getting pressured and niggled by all of your relatives during that time of year, and then suddenly you have to go back, and it really comes as a shock. That's been my impression of people who are, confused over should they stay or should they go, essentially.
Roseanne, when we see President Xi and all the people surrounding him, though the cult of personality is pretty strong, somewhat akin to Mao, some would say, I don't see a lot of women, but these are highly educated women. They are young. What is their impact on the political process going to be as you see it?
Politics is an area where I don't see many women being involved. I mean, there are none on the standing committee, and there are just a handful. I think it's something like 11 out of 245. Don't quote me exactly. Those are roughly the numbers. They have a very, very weak participation in politics. Where they're most poised to make an impact, I would say, would be in areas that are, anything related to commerce. Alibaba traditionally has involved a lot of women, either, as sellers on the websites or even some, executives within the company itself. Mm. There are a lot of Chinese women extremely active in the VC space. They're investing in tech companies. They're investing in AI at rates that I would say rival, if not exceed, the participation of American women in the VC space. They're just there. They came to the game a little bit later, but they're very, very present. That's where I would say they're able to make the biggest push, and that's an important part of what China is.
Oh, right? Absolutely. China says they want to dominate the AI space by the year 2030. So if they're in the vanguard of that movement, that should give them quite a bit of economic power.
Absolutely. And that's where I think they could make their impact. It's more from the business perspective than from the political perspective.
Now, George Orwell, when we go back to 1984, he had a warning about totalitarianism. And when you look at China's government today, it does look as if they are building the ultimate surveillance state. They've got this social credit score about trustworthiness and the shape that your life is and so forth, and it's going to affect their society in profound ways. What is going to be the debit on the record of these women, the fact that they're not married, given this new social credit?
Well, I honestly haven't given that one too much thought. If anything, the government needs these women more than the women need the government, right? They can leave. They're not involved in the government anyway. I'm not sure that it's going to be sort of that they're going to get points on their card in that way. It's all probably a bit too new to understand what the full implications would be, but I'm not too worried about that. I also cover Cuba, so I'm not easily scared.
Well, left over in China, the women shaping the world's next superpower, and I can't tell you how interesting and really enlightening this has been. So, Roseanne Lake, thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you so much, Larry. It was my pleasure.